stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. We are live on this Tuesday afternoon. Delighted to be with you. And here to take your phone calls about any sort of question that you may have about the Catholic faith. And here's that phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email if that is how you roll. The address for that is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Ace McKay is handling social media for us, which would include YouTube and Facebook, because we're streaming on both those platforms right now. You can ask a question right there just by putting it in the chat screen. Ace will see it. He'll do a quick copy-paste sent into us here in the studio. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, my friend?
I'm fine. I was just killing time while you're doing the announcements, looking up a family legacy website.
Yeah?
And I found out that my very much alive mother is actually dead. I've been wrong this whole time.
Oh, no.
So they got that wrong.
She didn't get the memo? Is that the problem?
She didn't get the memo, I guess. didn't show up for her own funeral.
That's a problem.
You remember what Yogi Berra said about that? Go to your friends' funerals or else they won't go to yours.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like pretty much everything Yogi Berra ever said, I think. We're going to lead off today with a question we received overnight on the EWTN listener comment line.
Yes, my name is Gwen, and I'm from Lansing, Michigan. And my question is, in the Our Father, which Jesus taught us, it says, lead us not into temptation. And I don't understand that, because if God is all perfect, all good, why could he possibly lead us into anything that is not good, a temptation?
Yeah,
Thank you.
That's a great question. So your intuition is shared by not a small number of people, including all of the French bishops, right, who a few years ago decided to change the language of the Lord's Prayer to make it say something more along the lines of, don't let us fall into temptation, right? Because they didn't like that active verb that made it sound like God was the one doing the leading.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm very happy that the Holy See did not impose that reasoning on the Universal Church. It did not, and the American bishops have got more biblical knowledge than the French bishops possibly, because we've retained the traditional language, and it's not arbitrary, because if you go back and read the language in the original Greek of the New Testament, you find out that the verb lead there means actually something stronger than lead, right? So the very same verb is used in the story of the paralytic whose friends carry him and place him at the feet of Jesus. So think about what's going on. Like what verb would you use to describe picking somebody up and dumping him someplace else? They dump him at the feet of Jesus. That's the word that Jesus uses when he says, don't do that to us with respect to temptation. Mm. That's a pretty strong image of God like actively dumping you into the pit of temptation. And the traditional theological position is that God does in fact lead people into temptation. He doesn't cause you to sin. That St. James is clear about that. God doesn't make you sin. But he does, in fact, lead you into temptation, though you can ask not to have this happen. And St. Thomas Aquinas asks the question, why would God do that? And there's a couple of reasons why God might do it. One of them comes up in Romans chapter 1, when St. Paul tells us that sometimes God allows sin to be sin's own punishment. Right? Sin is sin because it's not good for you. And when you suffer the consequences of it, you wake up with a hangover the next day. and you're like, I'm not doing that again, right? Until the next time you do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes God allows people to sin because he's punishing them for sin and allowing sin to be the punishment of sin, right? So Thomas gives that as one reason. Here's another reason. So that you can grow in virtue. You know, in moral theology, there is a distinction between an intemperate man, right, who runs around and indulges his passions, a continent man who does not indulge his passions but does so with difficulty, and a temperate man who has the virtue of temperance who doesn't indulge his passions and does so easily. And so you start out intemperate, then you move up the scale to continent, and then from there you make it to temperance. Well, how do you get from continence to temperance? By actively resisting temptation.
Sure.
Right? So you know, it's like maybe little micro temptations that you can overcome, and then you can indulge bigger temptations. You know, there are certain ministries where St. Paul says, don't go into that if you're going to be tempted yourself. You know, don't go to, you know, I had a friend one time that told me that that he got together with another guy because they were going to kind of exchange notes on how to handle their temptations to sins of the flesh. And because they were trying to help each other grow in virtue. And then they realized that by recounting them, they were actually like prone to commit them. And they said, you know, this is not actually working. Our attempt to overcome the sin is actually engendering the sin because we don't have the strength to sit here and talk about it without fantasizing about it, right?
Yeah.
And so Paul recognizes it. He says, don't go into that if you're not strong enough for it yet. But there are people who could go into a ministry where they're exposed to sordid things and not be at all tempted by it. But to get there, you have to be strengthened in virtue, and you can do that by actually actively resisting temptation, right? So that's another way. And then finally, God might lead us into temptation so that by not doing the thing, we can actually acquire merit.
Ah.
Right? Because Christ rewards us. You know, he says, don't pray in public to be seen by men, but pray in secret. Well, you know, he might allow the temptation to vainglory so that we would resist, go pray in secret, and not to be seen by men. And then God, in fact, will reward us for doing so. So those are three reasons why God might lead you to sin without actually wanting you to sin.
Thanks so much for your phone call to
I said lead you to sin. I should have said lead you to temptation, not
Thank
lead you.
You
to sin.
Sorry Appreciate about that. That. Yeah. All right. That was from our EWTN listener comment line. Appreciate that. In a moment, we'll get to the phones and talk with Tom in Twinsburg, Ohio, and hopefully you as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Lines are open now for Call to Communion. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We are live for you on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. We'll get to the phones in a second here. You know, the month of March is devoted to honoring St. Joseph. Since St. Joseph was the foster father of Jesus, he was continually working for his family, the Holy Family, providing for them, protecting them. You know, St. Padre Pio said, go to Joseph with extreme confidence, because I do not remember having asked anything from St. Joseph without having obtained it readily. St. Joseph, the patron saint of the Universal Church, unborn babies, families, fathers, those seeking employment, realtors, and a happy death. Join this devotion to St. Joseph with novenas, prayers, art, books, gifts, rosaries, chaplets, statues, and nativity sets, all available for you at EWTNRC.com. That's EWTNRC.com. I was just checking on the religious catalog website during the break there. I was looking for a particular item for a certain person's birthday coming up. Sure enough, they've got it. So that's what I'm going to do as soon as we're off the air is do check that out. Right now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Tom in Twinsburg, Ohio, listening on the Great Annunciation Radio. Hey there, Tom. What's on your mind today?
Yes. Heliocentrism was demonstrated in 1728 by the aberration of starlight, but the church did not remove Galileo's book from the Index of Forbidden Books until 1835. Why the delay, and what was it teaching during the 100 or more years that, yes.
Yeah, I got the question. So when heliocentrism began to be circulated in the Renaissance period as an astronomical theory to explain the observable data, the position of popes, including Urban VIII, I mean, who used to meet and talk to Galileo, and as well as cardinals and Catholic scientists and philosophers, was that this was a really interesting theory, that it did a good job of explaining the phenomena. But it's one thing to explain the observable phenomena with a theoretical model. It's another thing to say that the model actually captures the underlying physical reality, which you might not be able to have direct access to. And it's somewhat analogous to the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics that says we don't really know what the subatomic world is. We just know how to model it mathematically. David Merman, I think, is his name, a contemporary quantum physicist, when asked, yeah, but what is it, responds, shut up and calculate, right? Like the question is unanswerable. We don't know what the physical reality is at the subatomic level, you know, Ant-Man not you know, withstanding.
Yeah.
We just know how to model some of its effects. And so the church took a kind of instrumentalist, if you will, Copenhagen view of astronomical phenomena. We know we can create models that will capture the phenomena. We don't actually know what the physical reality is. And there were reasons to be biased in favor of geocentrism. One, the stature and fame of Aristotle, deservedly famous. I mean, Aristotle was a genius beyond compare, whose comprehensive vision of physical reality had proved so useful to and fruitful in scientific imagination and philosophical imagination, so that it had the weight of science on its side. That was the perception, you know. Heliocentrism, you know, was not just a empirical theory. It also had roots in Renaissance Neoplatonism, which were, you know, essentially philosophical and aesthetic. As you pointed out, it wasn't actually demonstrated during Galileo's lifetime. But it was an allowable hypothesis. What was controversial was the claim that it necessarily captures the underlying physical reality. It's not just a mathematical model, and that doctrine should be promoted as the truth without empirical confirmation. Galileo attempted to produce some empirical arguments that turned out to have been false. Now, by happenstance, he was right on the theory, right? Mm-hmm. But his alleging that the existence of tides proves heliocentrism is ridiculous. That's not what tides are caused by. And his contemporaries knew it, so they weren't impressed by his empirical arguments. But he disobeyed a church order about publishing on this thing in a way that would make it something other than a mere hypothesis. Now, Bellarmine, the church's chief theologian at the time, discussed the possibility that Galileo might be correct. And because of the prevalence of Aristotle and the phenomenology of observation, the prejudice was in favor of reading geocentrism and of reading associated passages of Scripture the same way. The sun rises, the sun sets, you know, here's the sun moving, and so forth. And so Bellarmine asks the question, what would it do to our theology if it turns out that Galileo is correct? And note that he entertains the possibility Galileo may be correct, right? And he says, well, if Galileo turns out to be correct, then it will be the case that we misinterpreted our own tradition, right? He doesn't say our tradition will be falsified, and he doesn't say, well, we'll just reject the science. He says, well, we'll go back and reinterpret the texts in a way that will conform to empirical reality. Now, centuries before, St. Thomas in the Summa has a section where he discusses different cosmological models deriving from ancient Greek philosophy. Mm-hmm. And the way he handles them is to say, well, let's see how each of these, and they're all different, how each of these might be reconciled with the data of Revelation. He doesn't just reject them out of hand. He says, well, they're all different. Don't know which one's right, if any of them. But I think it's possible to reconcile them with Revelation in a way where faith and reason don't actually conflict. Now, I want to contrast that attitude with modern fundamentalism, the phenomenon of young earth creationism. You know, there are fundamentalist Protestants that believe that the world is 10,000 years old. Now, when you show them empirical data, astronomical data, for example, that suggests that, you know, the universe is several billion years old, rather than saying, oh, I misinterpreted the text of my own tradition, which is what the Catholic Church says you should do, their response is to say, oh, well, obviously God created the world with the appearance of age 10,000 years ago. So they posit an unverifiable, unscientific hypothesis, right, that allows them to keep their interpretation and just deny empirical reality.
Wow.
And the church never took that position, right? Yeah. And so once the empirical data began to emerge that validated heliocentrism, Catholic philosophers and scientists were very quick to adopt it, right? That's a different question from when do you pull somebody's name off an index? It's a very different question.
Sure.
And one of the reasons why the Copernican model was controversial was because the church had already gone through the upheaval of the Protestant Reformation. And for that matter, by the way, most of the early Protestants were vehemently against Copernicus on scriptural grounds.
Really?
On scriptural grounds, right. And the sense that the world had been turned upside down was sufficiently destabilizing that they didn't want to literally turn the cosmos upside down on people, right? And Galileo's disobedience of a church directive was what was regarded as blamable more than his theory. It was his behavior that was problematic. And the fact that the scientific establishment buys into a theory isn't the same thing as promoting the idea that this should be distributed among the hoi polloi. Now,
yeah.
Today we live in a much more egalitarian and information-driven culture. And so this is a bit obscure to us, but most cultures at most times, Catholic and otherwise, have been effectively elitist in their view of intellectual culture. And in fact, in our own country today, there's a profound anti-elitist bias. So it's sort of a cultural division from the other side. But the idea that, you know, the elites of whatever culture in the hoi polloi don't share a common vocabulary and that striving for one, you know, is a complicated process. I mean, this is not just a Catholic phenomenon. It's a very traditional, normal one. I'm not justifying. I'm just describing the history.
Sure, sure.
It doesn't surprise me that the church, you know, is not rushing to rehabilitate Galileo, even while all Catholic scientists and philosophers had acknowledged that he was right, because, you know, the question of his moral status and obedience to magisterial authority is still in play. Now, after a certain point, it becomes kind of scandalous not to normalize the guy, and so the church does. Now, does that require, as a Catholic, do I have to think that church policy decisions are prudent, let alone infallible? No. So let's make the argument that the church was just dumb as nails to wait that long. Okay, that does nothing to my Catholic faith. I know people that do dumb as nail things in the Catholic Church all the time.
Mm.
Bishops, popes, priests, lay people, radio hosts, just we're just one big sack of dumb nails, you know. That but nothing in the Catholic faith is challenged by the acknowledgement that individual Catholics, including popes, can make ridiculously imprudent decisions.
Tom, thanks so much for your call today. We have several lines open for you here on EWTN's Call to Communion, 833-288-EWTN is that number, 833-288-3986. Let's go to South Dakota now and talk with Margie, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hello, Margie. What's on your mind today?
Hello. I just wanted to ask Dr. Anders, I know he's talked about this before, but I've forgotten, and a few of us were discussing it this morning, whether or not God has emotion. Now, we know that Jesus turned the tables over in the temple, so we clearly see that that's an emotion. So I was just wanting him to expand on
that. Yeah, thanks. So Jesus is a human being who also happens to be God. As a human being, he has everything that a human being has. If he doesn't, he's not a human being, right? So Jesus has a liver. Jesus has you know, a gallbladder, right? He has a completely useless appendix, right? He's got all of these things that humans have, including a human soul, including human soul. He has a human brain. He has human neurology. He has human neurotransmitters, and thus he has human emotion. Mm. As a human, he has all these things. Prior to the incarnation, God, the divinity, the Godhead, does not have emotions because God doesn't have a body. And the Godhead continues to not have a body as the Godhead. He has a body insofar as the hypostatic union unites the humanity of Christ to the second person. But God, qua God, does not have a body and therefore does not have emotions. Now, if you read the Old Testament, which of course is not talking about the incarnate Christ, but about the Godhead, God is depicted as being a highly emotional character. I admit this. Catholic tradition has never thought that those were truth functional descriptions of God, but that they were metaphorical, figurative descriptions of God adapted to human experience, but that God considered as the first cause of the universe, immaterial, eternal, uncreated, immense, ubiquitous, omniscient, and so forth, does not have emotions because God, as God, does not change.
Margie, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you and your friends there. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. Anders, 833-288-3986. Maybe you'd like to tell us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Here's a question now from Gil, who says, why would God put the tree of knowledge in the garden if he knew Adam and Eve would fall?
So the question as to why God created a world in which he foresaw that humans would freely choose to sin is a great mystery. But it is a decision that allowed for redemption via the incarnation, which is a great good.
Yeah.
Hence, the Catholic Church celebrating in the Easter liturgy what we call our happy fault, the felix culpa, that won for us so great a redeemer. No fall of Adam, no incarnation of Christ. I don't care what you say, John Duns Scotus, right, who took a different position.
Yeah.
And thus, God allowed the fall in order to bring about a greater good, the greater good of the hypostatic union and our union with Christ in grace and our deification and sharing with Christ in glory at the resurrection.
And we do appreciate that. Thanks, Gil, for your email. Here's one now from Xavier. In the Gospel of Luke, seems to be a problem with the historical details of the census. How can I respond to someone who finds it invalid because of this?
Well, then maybe there are historical problems in the census. And so maybe your doctrine of inspiration needs to be adjusted to allow for the possibility that Luke wasn't doing a scientific census or doing the kind of scientific historiography that modern historians would be held to, right? Maybe Luke is adopting the style and methods and genre of ancient Hebrew and Hellenistic historiography, which is geared much more in the direction of moralistic storytelling, in which historical details are sort of selected in a kind of ad hoc and loose manner in the service of a theological narrative. And he's not so interested in giving you the kind of stenographer's report that, say, a modern historian would be aiming for according to the canons of modern historiography.
Sure. Appreciate that. Thanks so much for your question there on EWTN's Call to Communion. A couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Standing by, Simon in Indiana. Also, Chris in Orange County, California. Lots more straight ahead on the last half hour of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us for the Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion. We're live. We're here taking your calls at 833-288-EWTN. Two lines open right now, 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. Off we go to Simon in Indiana, listening to us online, EWTN.com. Hey there, Simon, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Anders. Can you all hear me all right?
Yeah, go right ahead, Simon.
Sure. It's been a few years since I called in, I think. So I was just listening to an older episode, not too much older, of Call to Communion toward the beginning of Lent, and Dr. Anders was talking about genres of biblical literature and how they're not really comparable to modern historiography. And I agree with Dr. Anders. There are aspects of Genesis that I think would be foolish to take in a fundamentalist or literalistic sort of way. And I'm a convert to Catholicism for context from Protestantism. But I'm wondering, at what point do we take this tendency of deriving spiritual or typological, figurative, or idiomatic meanings from text according to genre? At what point does that devolve into deconstructionism, where everything becomes figurative, and I'm not accusing Dr. Anders of doing this, of course. It's just a hypothetical.
Yeah, but I appreciate the question, and I understand it. So, first of all, I wouldn't characterize deconstructionism as the position that everything is figurative. I think deconstructionism is the position that texts have no stable meaning, and that's a very different kind of question, right? Now, here are some rules. First of all, the way you do this in a way that is stable and not destructive to faith is you read it within the context of the church, and you're guided by the mind and the teaching of the church, right? And so, I'm never going to read the text of Scripture in a way that leads me to the conviction that Catholics should not believe in the dogma of the Trinity. Regardless of what I may actually conclude about the meaning of a passage of John or Paul's letter to the Philippians, or, and I can get into all kinds of higher critical questions about what these texts may or may not have meant in context. But the Catholic Church has defined as a dogma of the faith that Catholics believe in the Trinity. So whatever I learn from higher criticism is going to be integrated into a Catholic dogmatic system because I am a practicing Catholic. That's a firm boundary on where I'm going to go, right? It doesn't mean I can't read the text in other ways, but I'm not going to read them in other ways charismatically. I'm not going to take those ways and say, this is the teaching of the church. Well, it's not the teaching of the church. I know what the teaching of the church is, and I'm a Catholic, so I hold the teaching of the church, right? So that's a firm boundary on that kind of, that kind of ideological drift that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What some of the church fathers did, and I'm thinking in particular about Gregory of Nyssa, is when they came across passages, and Origen too, of course, that they thought on moral or theological grounds, not historical ones, but on moral or theological grounds, couldn't be true if taken at face value, then they didn't take him at face value. And Origen famously says it's impossible to take parts of the Genesis narrative at face value. Say, for instance, the language that God walked in the garden, because we know that God doesn't have feet, so he can't walk.
Yeah.
Nyssa looks at certain events in the Pentateuch and says, if taken at face value, these would predicate things that were unworthy of God. Therefore, they couldn't have happened that way, and we should take this text and read it spiritually. I know you've heard me say this before, but I see precedents for this in Jesus, who, when confronted with the bare letter of the law that says you are supposed to execute women caught in adultery, he refuses to execute somebody caught in adultery. He says, we're not going to go where the text told us to go because it asks us to do something that is flat counter to the ethic of love and forgiveness that I'm preaching, which he then grounds in the doctrine of God that he derives from higher principles of the Bible that the Bible itself does not identify as being higher, right? So Christ brings a hermeneutical criteria to his reading of the Old Testament that the Old Testament itself does not necessarily suggest. He does the same thing with the teaching on divorce. St. Paul, of course, does this as well. When he reads his experience of the risen Christ emphatically into his reading of Old Testament, and at times leads him to allegorize. So we're in good company, Christ and Paul. I'd say that's pretty good company. And we're guided by the mind of the church and the example of the fathers. There is a document from the Pontifical Biblical Commission published in 2014 called On the Inspiration and Truth of Holy Scripture that takes pretty much exactly the position I just took, but it goes into much more depth. It's about 100 pages long,
mm-hmm.
and you can find it online. So if you want more detail, and this is the Pontifical Biblical Commission is not the Pope. It consists of respected biblical scholars and theologians that are nominated by their own bishops' conferences. And so, like, you know, the U.S. bishops, I believe, nominated Mary Healy, who's the editor of the Catholic Commentary series. The French bishops will nominate somebody. The Italian bishops will nominate somebody. And then the Pope selects them, and they form the commission. And the commission's job is to investigate questions of biblical scholarship and advise the Holy See. And so, you know, their positions, while not infallible dogmatic teaching, would definitely represent the consensus of scholars who absolutely have the approbation of the church. So I'd say if you're safe holding their opinions, you're not obligated to, but you're definitely safe holding their opinions. So take a look at the Pontifical Biblical Commission.
So, Simon, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, that's all very helpful. And just as a specific or individual case of where this question could be applied that you were speaking of, Doctor, I think what you were saying in the previous episode is that the Pentateuch was composed during the time of Ezra, I believe, after the Babylonian and Assyrian exiles, and I have no problem with that as a scholarly position. But do we derive from that sort of realistic approach to the text, or could we derive that Moses didn't really write the Pentateuch, or what is the church's position on that, if it has one?
Yeah, sure. So when you read Pope Benedict in unscripted moments, like his interviews and so forth, he will sometimes hint at positions that would have made Pius X quake in his boots, okay, with respect to these kinds of questions. The creed tells me that Christ was born of the Blessed Virgin Mary by the Holy Spirit and suffered under Pontius Pilate. It gives me a hard historical reference point that is a dogma of the church. It's not clear to me that it does so with any other historical character, a little bit with the character of Adam. Although it doesn't place him in time and space, it places him theologically mm-hmm. in relationship to Christ, mm-hmm. but leaves a lot of leeway about how to play that out. Doesn't really give me that. Now, you know, I understand that there's a history of Catholic interpretation of the Pentateuch going back to the patristic era that took the text. When it didn't seem to offend faith or morals, they took the narrative portions of the Pentateuch more or less at face value. I get that. I understand that. But neither were they confronted with the kind of tools that we have today, with higher criticism, with archaeology, with geology, with anthropology, right? And so I know traditionalists that say, you know, any place the fathers seem to have held an opinion, then we have to hold that opinion. And that leads some of them all the way into geocentrism. I have known radical traditionalist Catholics that are geocentrists. They reject, you know, the Copernican view of the solar system on patristic grounds. And I think that's ridiculously naive, obviously, and so do all the modern popes, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't go that far. And, you know, in my view, the way to think about the consensus of the fathers is the way the Pontifical Commission thinks about it, which is things like the doctrine of the unity of the testaments, the centrality of Christ, the allegorical method of interpretation. So they're formal convictions about the nature of the text rather than specific material judgments about individual historical people.
Simon, great to hear from you today from Indiana on EWTN's Call to Communion. Appreciate your phone call. Let's go now to Sue in Galesburg, Illinois, listening to us on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, Sue. What's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you. I love your show. I've learned so much. In fact, people think that I know a lot about the faith, which I don't, but it's what I do know is because of you guys. So thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
My question is really easy compared to the last two, maybe. when Dr. Andrews said that God the Father does not have emotions, that kind of upsets me because I just kind of figured out that he loved me.
Sure.
Yeah. And then I've got another question if you have time.
Okay. So could there be anything better than human love?
Yes.
Of course. Okay. Is God just a great big human? Is he just human love in a higher key? No. There's something better than human love. It's not less than human love. It's better than human love. So, you know, what is it that you want out of human love? Well, you want to be known. You want to be made whole. You want to be validated. You want the relationship to be, like Carl Rogers would say, like an opportunity for personal discovery and self-transcendence, where you can develop and individuate your personality and reach your full potential. All of these sort of aspirations are the things that you're looking for when you're looking for human interrelational love, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, if God, and of course, we're just babbling when we use this language, but if God is like the sum total of all intelligible reality, has its roots and origins in him, and all goodness, and is the finality of creation, like we're, you know, by being united to God, we're growing towards him, becoming more like him, all of those aspirations are met, right? Without having to reduce God to an anthropomorphic caricature. Now, I feel the difficulty that you have, right? Personally, deeply. I mean, I'm not denying that it's a challenge to integrate what the church teaches dogmatically about the nature of God, say philosophically, with my lived phenomenal experience. I mean, I had a great close relationship with my human father, and there are times when, to be quite honest, like, I know what love means when my dad loved me. I struggle to know what it means sometimes when God loves me. And the temptation is to just turn God into a great big version of my father. But I know that God is something better than that. And when I think of God, when I know that God is the infinite source and origin of all of the knowledge, all of the personal, all of the perfection, all of the transcendence, all of the beauty and truth that I'm striving to realize in my interpersonal relationships, then I have some way of approaching that asymptotically, you know, little bit by little bit with, you know, growing and understanding. And I know you've heard me use this metaphor before, but, you know, if you think about God on the analogy of the sun, with light beaming down on earth, which is this warm and utterly desirable source of knowledge, of being, of growth, of actualization, that is the condition that makes all life on earth possible and all growth on earth. And, and God is like that with respect to being. You know, God, Dionysius the Areopagite said that God is the being that beings have. You know,
I'm
trying to actualize, you know, bring to fruition the totality of my being as a creature in God, in whom I live and move and have my being, right? And that means, of course, my capacity for love, right? My capacity to bind myself in charity to another human being and to discover the intimate depths and truth of another person and to be open to that and to be transformed by it, right? And God is the condition of that possibility. And of course, who wears a human face in the incarnation? See, that's the key difference, right? That we're not just Neoplatonists, mm-hmm. right? Because Plotinus never had the ultimate reality taking on a human face and being born of a virgin in a womb in Bethlehem in Judea, you know, 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so God comes to us in a human face through the incarnation. So I don't know if that's helpful to you, but the benefit of the Catholic doctrine, first of all, is it reminds us that God is infinitely distant from us, and it helps prevent us from making idols, right? And it's very mm-hmm. easy to make an idol of our concept of God, and there are many traditions that do anthropomorphize God and relationship, and what happens is they end up deifying their own interior emotions and calling them the Holy Spirit. You know, the guy that walks out of the happy clappy worship service and says, "Oh, I really felt the Spirit move today," when no, what he felt was the key change. You know, and And that's a danger, right? When the real passage into God can sometimes be without motion, without feeling, in aridity, in darkness even, in pain and suffering. And sometimes God is at work the most in us when we feel the least. I mean, that's the teaching of Catholic mystics.
And we thank you so much for your call, Sue. I wish we could get in your second question, but we got sold out phones. We got to keep moving here. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. Coming up next on most of these EWTN stations, it's EWTN Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Menezes, your Tuesday host, taking your calls on faith, family, and fellowship. Straight ahead, 3 p.m. Eastern on most of these EWTN stations. Let's go to Orange County now and talk with Chris, listening on the EWTN app. Hello, Chris. What's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon, morning or afternoon, Dr. Anders. You have said that halal or halal food doesn't impact Catholics' diets or whatever kind of thing. But what's it all about?
Halal is a category of food within the Islamic tradition, and just like Jews have kosher food and non-kosher food, uh-huh. Muslims have halal food and non-halal food, things they're allowed to eat, things they're not allowed to eat. And Catholics can literally eat anything. You can go eat bugs if you want to. I mean, there's no restrictions on what Catholics can eat or not eat in terms of the religion. And except during Lent, of course, when you don't eat meat on Fridays. Although I found recently that if you're in Louisiana, you can eat alligator.
How about that?
I believe you can eat alligator. Oh, but don't quote me on that. But I'm pretty sure I read a letter from a Louisiana bishop that said alligator counts as fish for purposes of Lent. Also, capybaras, if you're in South America, you can eat.
Good to know.
But apart from that, yeah, we can eat anything we want all the time.
Appreciate your call from Orange County, Chris. Thank you for checking in. Here is Eric now in Denver watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Eric, what's on your mind today?
Yes. If I've got a migraine headache, a debilitating migraine headache, when I was a kid, my mom, the sisters at school, my grandma, they would tell me to offer it up. And I'm wondering that if I do offer it up, if I... after I offer it up, I end up taking two Advil to take care of the headache. Do I mitigate or negate my prayer?
Thank you so much. So as someone who has had a migraine more than once in my life, and as someone who is married to a habitual migraine sufferer, I am begging and pleading to you, take the medication.
Yes.
You know, my wife discovered a medication that just did wonders for her until... for another medical reason, she stopped being able to take it. But for a period there of a couple of years, it was just like the stuff. You take it and poof, headache goes, you know. It's wonderful. So please take the medication. Absolutely go to bed. Put the covers over your head. Turn off the lights. Put on the noise machine. You know, do whatever you need to do. There's no reason for you to seek out suffering. Sometimes when people tell kids, offer it up, what they mean is, shut up. I don't want to hear about it. Don't complain to me about your problem. And that's not compassion, right? That's not Catholic formation, you know. It's not offering the doctrine of offering up our sufferings is not a way to mitigate somebody else's pain and get them out of your face, right? We all have sufferings that we can't avoid, right? They could be physical pain, they could be circumstances in our lives. And we can take one or two attitudes toward them. You know, we can kick against the goads and whine and scream and get bitter and resentful about it. And guess what? You're still in pain.
Yep.
Right? Or you can surrender to God's providence and accept it, you know, for some reason I have this thing in my life that God has allowed to be here. It doesn't mean you can't use your prudent judgment to try to mitigate the bad consequences. But at some point, you've kind of run out of limits of what you can do, and sure, you're still up against it. But no, it's not going to mitigate. It's not going to hurt your spirituality if you don't live a masochistic life.
Eric, thanks for checking in Denver. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. We're going to stay right here in good old Birmingham, Alabama, talking with Elijah, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio, AM 1480. Hello, Elijah. What's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you. I have a question. So I recently learned about a concept in Orthodoxy. It's one word, which escapes me, but essentially it's where they'll relax some of the demands of moral theology because of present life circumstances. And I just wondered if you, A, knew of that, B, is that present in Eastern Catholic traditions? And then C, what would we say here in the West about that?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. I think you're talking about oikonomia is the Greek concept, and it's not a relaxation of moral standards as so much a kind of a therapeutic pastoral application of them that might, you know, tend to gentleness. You know,
okay.
Is there anything like that in the Catholic tradition? You bet, absolutely, right. And Pope Francis was a major proponent of that way of approaching pastoral theology, and he wrote an encyclical called Amoris Laetitia on the doctrine of marriage that stirred up quite a bit of controversy because he was pushing the idea to extremes that it hadn't been seen before in the Catholic tradition. But you might take a look at that document. But there's also, some pretty tried and true concepts in Catholic moral theology. One of them is the concept of gradualism. And gradualism means that if you're in pastoral work, that you are happy if you can move someone incrementally towards the good.
Right? Okay, all right.
And, unlike Protestantism that tends to take a very black and white view, something is either a sin or it isn't. And I said Protestantism, I'll just narrow it down to Calvinism.
Right? Okay.
Something's either a sin or it isn't. And if it is, it deserves damnation. Right, that tends to be the Calvinist view. The Catholic view is like, no, sin differs from sin in gravity. There is such a thing as progress in sin and having less vice in one's life. And incremental progress on the way to holiness is progress and worth making. And so, Pope Benedict made a really, it was misunderstood, and I'll probably be misunderstood when I quote it. But he made an example of this kind of concept when he dealt with a hypothetical. And the hypothetical was, let's say you have a homosexual couple engaging in sexual intercourse that the church regards as deeply immoral, and one of them has AIDS or some other deadly communicable disease, and so employs a kind of barrier technology that would prevent the transmission of the disease during the otherwise immoral act. And the Pope said, this is an immoral act, right? This is an immoral act. But at least there's an acknowledgement that I should try to refrain from hurting the other person in at least one way. Now, I'm still hurting the person in another way.
Yeah.
I'm hurting their dignity and their moral status as a child of God through this immoral action. But at least I'm acknowledging that I don't want to kill them or be the cause of their physical death. And the Pope said, like, the move from not doing that to doing that, it's not a very big step. It is a step. And his attitude was, I can work with that. Give me a step. Give me one step in the right direction. I'll work with that, and I'll try to get you to take the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And so in pastoral application, one of the most orthodox and conservative priests I ever knew in my entire life, who was, this was nobody's liberal, okay? He once boasted of being a narrow-minded bigot from the north of Ireland, all right? told me that in pastoral counseling in the confessional, he would sometimes deliberately leave people in ignorance if he judged that by revealing the truth to them, they would not follow through, because he didn't want to leave them with a bad conscience.
Mm.
And he didn't want to lay a command on them that he knew they wouldn't keep, right?
Wow.
And so the goal was gradually bring them to embrace more and more of the truth. Now, that's not a moral relativism. There's still, here is the good, here is what's not good.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to get them from the not good to the good, but a recognition that sometimes that's going to happen incrementally and over time and requires pastoral prudence.
Elijah, thanks so much for your call. We have just enough time for Tim's question in Washington, listening on KTMB. Tim, we got about 30, 40 seconds. What's on your mind? Tim, are you there?
Hello. Yes, this is him. Sorry. Thank you, guys. I'm not very eloquent, but I'll try to say what I want. I'm wondering if you think there might be a correlation between the way people interpret the scriptures in their own lives, the way God communicates to them through the scriptures, and in their own interior life. For example, I know that there are a lot of people who read the Bible very literalistically, and then there are also a lot of Christians out there who are like, well, I received this word from God.
We're about to run out of time, so I'm going to interrupt you and jump in with the answer. It's a great intuition on your part. Absolutely that happens. Absolutely that happens.
There it is. Tim, thanks so much for your call. Calls are still coming in. I would ask those folks, you've got a choice, folks. You can either hang on for EWTN Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade, or you can call us back tomorrow and we'll put you at the head of the class here. And there it is. Father, Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep it right here on EWTN for great Catholic programming. We are indeed your Lenten companion. A lot of great programming for you all the way up through Holy Week and Easter. Keep it right here on EWTN. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, have a wonderful day and God bless.